I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, are hedge funds no longer as much fun? But first, a Supreme Court decision out today will make it harder for employees complaining of pay discrimination to sue their employers. Lily Ledbetter sued Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, claiming that after 19 years on the job, she was making $6,000 a year less than the lowest paid man doing the same work. In a 5-4 decision today, the court sided with Goodyear. Well, for more on this case and an update on what's left on the court's docket this term, we go to Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com. And Lyle, today's decision centered on when the woman, Lily Ledbetter, filed this claim. Under the law, we understand you must sue within 180 days of the alleged discriminatory behavior. She sued after she quit the company. So explain the decision.
The court decided that if there is a differential in pay, that is, women are paid less than men, the original decision to make that difference is what starts the clock to running on the time to file a claim of unequal pay.
So it's when you're first hired and then 180 days from there?
Well, whenever the pay decision is made, you know, it could be early on, it could be at any time, but more than likely it would be early in your tenure. And then the court said that each new paycheck does not constitute a separate violation, so it doesn't start the clock running all over again. The dissenters said essentially what this means is you must sue very early, and you must sue even before you know for sure whether or not your pay is really lower than what men are getting.
I was going to say that's the problem with that, because salaries aren't transparent.
Yeah, it was a 5-4 split, and the dissenters were pretty angry. Normally, Justice Ginsburg, doesn't read out a dissenting opinion unless she feels very strongly. Well, she said that the court simply does not understand or is indifferent to the ways in which women can be victims of discrimination on the job. So it was a pretty harsh critique.
Well, let's review some of the other big cases that are still pending. Two campaign finance cases. They deal with whether Congress can ban advertisements that focus on political issues but mention a candidate's name. One of the cases involves Wisconsin's Right to Life organization. And the question is whether that group can do, let's say, an anti-abortion ad, and in that ad mention a candidate's name. They would say it's not a, let's say, presidential ad. It's just an issue ad. What were the arguments in this case?
Well, the argument is that this kind of ad, it actually is protected by the First Amendment so long as it doesn't say vote for a candidate or vote against a candidate, so long as it picks out a public policy issue and says write to your senator or your congressman. And a lower court said if that's all that you do, mention a policy issue and say write to your member, you can run that ad on radio or on television. It does appear, Robin, that when the court decides this case, they're probably going to relax the federal controls.
Another question is about students and free speech. This is a case that came out of Alaska where a student unfurled a banner saying bong hits for Jesus as the Olympic torch passed, hoping to get some television camera time. The principal ripped it out of his hands and suspended him. We understand one side of this issue thinks that this is an issue of drugs. Another side thinks it's an issue of free speech.
Well, and it came to the court primarily as a constitutional question about students' free speech rights. And it does appear, at least from the hearing that was held in this case, that the court may be willing to give school officials some additional authority to censor students' speech at school-sponsored events in the interest of trying to tamp down the drug culture. So it looks like student free speech rights are going to take a hit in this case.
There are also two cases that involve race-based enrollment in public schools, one out of Louisville and one out of Seattle. Who is bringing the case to court and what do they want?
These are lawsuits by parents in Louisville and Seattle attempting to challenge the policies of those two school systems that resulted in their children not being able to go to the school that they wanted them to because of school policy of making some assignments to schools based upon whether a student was black or white.
Now, these were white parents who objected that the schools were looking to be more diverse and so were bringing children of color in as opposed to their white kids.
That's it, Robin, exactly. This has the potential, Robin, for being a major retreat on the use of race as a positive or affirmative factor in trying to preserve something like a racial balance in the school, so the students actually go to school with students of different races and cultures.
Lyle Denniston of SCOTUSblog.com with the latest on what's in the pipeline for the Supreme Court this term. Lyle, thanks as always.
All right, you're happy to do it, Robin.
Okay, dust off your suspenders. He's coming back.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed for life, for money, for love, knowledge, has marked the upward surge of mankind, and greed, you mark my words, will not only save Teldar Paper, but that other malfunctioning corporation called the USA. Thank you very much.
Gordon Gekko, villain of the 1987 Oliver Stone film Wall Street, was last seen heading off to jail for going too far with his greed is good credo. Well, soon, Michael Douglas will resurrect his Oscar-winning role in a sequel to Wall Street called Money Never Sleeps. In it, Gekko returns to the financial district, this time as the manager of a hedge fund. You may have heard about hedge funds, even though they operate secretively and largely unregulated. They're said to be the real engines fueling the economy. Or no, wait, maybe they can bring down markets overnight. Well, there's no question. They manage about $2 trillion worldwide. They used to be for the super wealthy who invested big in the hopes of winning big and could afford to lose. But now the average American is rolling the dice as well, and so we decided to find out where hedge funds stand. Joining us to sift through the hedge fund haze, Jeff Colvin, senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
We know the term hedge as in, you know, hedge our bets. But can you tell us, you know, how does it translate into a hedge fund? What is a hedge fund? How does it work?
It's pretty simple, basically. It's a fund that accepts money from investors and invests it in ways that are supposed to make a profit. The thing is, it invests that money in all kinds of ways that normal mutual funds don't invest in. So they will not only buy stocks, the sort of normal thing, but they will sell stocks short.
I'm going to hold you up there for those who aren't investors yet. What do you mean by sell stocks short?
Well, what that means is simply the opposite of sort of buying a stock. Instead of buying it and holding it, you borrow stock from somebody who already owns it and sell it on the open market and then later buy it back to give it back to the person you borrowed from. And obviously that arrangement means that you will profit only if the price of the stock goes down. So selling short is the opposite of what most of us do. It's betting that the stock will go down.
Right, so that you can make a profit when you hand it back.
That's right.
Why are they unregulated, first of all? You mentioned mutual funds, the kind that invest in stocks. Why are hedge funds unregulated?
The reason they are largely unregulated is that they typically require a very large minimum investment, sometimes $1 million, sometimes $5 million. And so the logic is, look, these are not mom-and-pop investors who are putting their money into these things. These are either very wealthy individuals or institutions like pension funds or endowment funds. They know what they're doing, and so they don't need a lot of regulation to protect them.
And so it's sort of a buyer beware.
Yes, that's quite right.
It's your money. If you want to lose it, fine. How did they make their way so big into the financial scene?
By racking up some truly amazing returns. They've been around for a very long time. They really came into their own in the 90s, 80s and 90s, when there weren't very many of them. But the ones that existed, some of them made truly tremendous returns. They were averaging 30, 35, even 40% per year over a number of years. And that was so incredible. And the investors who were in them did so well that suddenly all kinds of other investors wanted to put their money into hedge funds. And then all kinds of managers decided they'd like to start hedge funds.
Give us one example of a hedge fund and what it might have invested in and the numbers that you're talking about, the big money.
Well, sure. A good one at the moment would be Renaissance, which is run by a man named James Simons, who is a former professor. He invests in ways that essentially no one understands. He has very complicated formulas and algorithms that he has worked out over the years. And he was a math professor. I mean, this is his thing. He has achieved huge returns, I think over 40% a year for a number of years. Because he's achieved such huge returns, he has attracted many billions of dollars from investors who want him to invest. And because of the very steep fees he charges for running his hedge fund, he personally, this is not a company, it's not a nation, it's him personally, he personally made $1.7 billion last year.
That's
a pretty
good
year.
Yeah, that's the budget of a nation.
That's the budget of a nation.
Several nations. Well, you mentioned the fees. Let's explain that. You know, how does it work for the investor? We understand there's a fee structure known as the 2 plus 20. How does that work?
2 and 20 is the typical fee structure. And what that means is the manager of the hedge fund takes, first of all, 2% of whatever is in the fund. So before any performance has been created at all, before there's been any work done, he takes 2% of that. Then he takes 20% of any profit. And this is usually defined in some more specific way. It's a profit above some particular hurdle or some particular benchmark. That is an enormous fee. Okay, the normal mutual fund will have a fee typically of less than 2%. An index fund will have a fee of less than 1%, sometimes less than half of 1%. And when they get up towards 2%, we start to say those fees are awfully excessive. But hedge funds charge 2% plus 20% of any profit.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, you know, eyebrows start raising around the money that fund managers are making. For example, Alpha Magazine, that's the business journal that tracks hedge funds, reported that the top 25 hedge fund managers took in an average $570 million last year, up more than $200 million from the year before. Their combined earnings, $14 billion. You mentioned James Simons of Renaissance Technologies. He topped the charts at $1.7 billion. 92% of these fund managers are men.
Yes.
You mentioned, you know, there's a certain alchemy. I mean, why are they? I mean, I suppose their investors think they're worth that money, and that's why they're worth that money.
That's right. And you're quite right in saying that it is sort of the perception of the ability to produce these fabulous returns that gets them all that money. Because, look, the way they invest, to some extent, is generally a black box. I mean, James Simons is a sort of an extreme example because he really does rely on formulas and algorithms that are a genuine black box. Nobody knows. He obviously has a huge interest in keeping them secret. But what everybody in the hedge fund business does is to some extent a black box. Some of them are unbelievably active traders, so you couldn't even keep track of what they were doing if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. So it's quite right. It's the ability of them to convince a bunch of investors that they can do this that attracts the money at first. If they have good years, then all is well. But what's often unnoticed is that if they have bad years, then things can unravel very quickly and, by the way, be really bad for the investors.
And maybe for the economy as well. And that has some economists and lawmakers wary. They're looking for more disclosure from managers of these trillion-dollar accounts. We're going to ask Fortune Magazine senior editor-at-large Jeff Colvin about those concerns. A reminder later today, an Iraqi on the new wall that divides his neighborhood. That's still ahead as well. Back after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from Jeff Colvin, senior editor-at-large for Fortune magazine, learning about hedge funds, those largely unregulated, somewhat secretive investment vehicles for the rich and wannabe rich. When the record-breaking earnings of hedge fund managers were made public late last month, the top 25 took in an average $570 million last year. Well, economists took note. Robert Kuttner in the Boston Globe warned that as competition becomes more intense to produce these exorbitant returns higher and higher, fund managers might take even bigger risks with this largely borrowed money, strike deals that can hurt the economy, maybe buy up companies that they then strip and sell, definitely widen the income inequity gap. So, Jeff, tell us a little more about the concerns about hedge funds.
Well, I'll tell you, there are those concerns, although those are always kind of hazy. In other words, you rarely see a scenario described that says exactly how something like that would happen. You know, I suppose it is possible because we all remember what happened sort of generally with long-term capital management, a very famous fund back in the late 90s when it collapsed and did cause repercussions in the global financial system that took some heroic actions on the part of central bankers to forestall. But I'll tell you, to me, the greater danger with hedge funds today is that they will simply produce lousy returns for the investors. There is so much money invested in them now, over $2 trillion, as you said. There are over 8,000 hedge funds today. For them all to beat the market is essentially impossible. There are so many of them, there's so much money in them, that they increasingly are the market. And so on average, they are just going to, by definition, produce a market return, but with this difference, they charge such enormous fees that what investors get will be really limited.
Well, and this is happening, check my thinking on this. Is this happening just as, I'm told by friends who are who dabble in this, people who aren't uber wealthy are getting into hedge funds? They just,
yes,
maybe they have a lot of extra money for the first time.
Yeah.
So it would seem as if it might be more painful.
That's exactly right. And that is what's happening. And in a way, it's inevitable. The big players got in a long time ago. The success of these funds is becoming very widely known. And so people who don't have that much money say, hey, you know, I'd like some of that terrific return also. Is there some way I could get in? I would love to put my $20,000 into a hedge fund. And of course, there are people who respond to that wish. So there are funds being set up that will accept investments that small. There are also so-called funds of funds, an investment company that will buy investments in lots of the major hedge funds and then sell them at a small minimum investment to ordinary investors, you know, regular civilians.
Right.
To me, that's a terrible idea because you've got the hedge fund fees themselves, and then the fund of funds extracts an additional fee.
Right.
Nonetheless, there are people lining up to do it.
And as you said, you know, those fees can go up to 40% of profit. And it's one thing if you put your million in and a billionaire puts a million in. If you lose your only million,
that's right,
you know, as opposed to the billionaire, it hurts more. Well, that's probably why a lot of lawmakers are starting to look at hedge funds. Here in the U.S., Harvey Pitt, who's the former head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, as you know, recently, you know, urged these hedge fund managers to set up their own regulatory organization, to self-regulate, to avert government scrutiny. We know that earlier this year, Senator Charles Schumer met with 20 or so top hedge fund managers, took them to dinner, I guess, and we understand, said to them, you know, we can do this the hard way or the easy way, meaning give me more disclosure about what you do so I don't have to think about regulating. Where do you think the future is?
Well, I think that what he told them is exactly right. They are now required to register with the SEC, but that doesn't mean very much. It just means that they sort of provide some very basic information. They have now become so large, there is so much money in them, that some form of extra disclosure and probably extra regulation is inevitable. I mean, if you have pension funds, you know, if you have a school teacher's pension fund putting money into a hedge fund, and that is a very common situation, then it is inevitable that there's going to be some extra information, some extra disclosure and regulation required. And I think that Senator Schumer was quite right in telling him what he told him. You know, you can do this yourself, but if you don't, or if what you do isn't satisfactory to us, then we're going to have to do it. And you can bet that these folks would rather not do it at all, but given that choice, they'd rather do it themselves.
We'll get some financial advice now. It sounds as if you're saying that unless you can really afford to lose some money as well as make some money, don't get involved with hedge funds. And maybe the time of the, you know, the glory days of hedge funds might be over soon, or?
I think that's a pretty fair thing to say. It is definitely true that some of them are going to earn tremendous returns. And so people will continue to be attracted to them because at the end of every year, you're going to read about a dozen hedge funds that earned fabulous returns. What you're not going to read about is all the ones that earned terrible returns or even shut down and had to return money to their investors. The fact is they have now become so numerous and so big that they are increasingly just going to reflect the market, and the average investor, the usual person like you and me, has no way of predicting in advance which ones are going to earn the tremendous returns. So absolutely, for the normal retail investor, they weren't made for us.
Accent on the us. I just want to ask you, we began by saying that there's going to be a new sequel to Wall Street, and it's going to feature Michael Douglas in the role of Gordon Gekko, now returning as a hedge fund manager in the new movie Money Never Sleeps. Is there buzz on Wall Street about this? Are you looking forward to this?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it. It does make perfect sense that he would be returning as a hedge fund manager. I mean, that's just the logical thing for him to be.
Well, we will perhaps call you for a review.
I'd be delighted.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
It's my pleasure. It's always fun to talk about.
Jeff Colvin, Senior Editor-at-Large for Fortune Magazine. For more on hedge funds, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Well, let's look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have a reporter's notebook with NPR's Ivan Watson on ever-changing life in Turkey. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the growing use of a dangerous cocktail of drugs from Brazil to lose weight. What's in them? Back after the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Florida recently, several hospital workers failed drug tests and were stunned to find out the culprit was amphetamines in their over-the-counter Brazilian diet pills. Here in Massachusetts, residents are also turning to a potent, illegal, and potentially dangerous cocktail of drugs to lose weight. The capsules here, sold sometimes in stores without prescriptions, have been found to contain amphetamine-like compounds and Valium-like tranquilizers. The diet pills are manufactured by Brazilian pharmacists, and they fall under the regulatory radar here in the U.S. Here Now's Alan Cockle reports.
One day, Odette Esselman noticed that a Brazilian acquaintance of hers seemed to be losing a lot of weight. Esselman wanted to shed a few pounds herself.
So I asked her how she was doing it, and she gave me the doctor's name and number to call in Brazil.
Odette phoned this doctor, who took some information and asked her to get some blood tests. She wired money to Brazil, and the pills arrived in the mail after a week. They packed a punch.
I wasn't hungry. I mean, at my 12-hour shift, sometimes I come home and say, oh my God, I haven't eaten.
She had coffee in the morning and tried to force herself to eat a bowl of cereal each evening. In 3 months, she dropped 37 pounds, going from a size 14 to a size 6, sometimes 4.
I go out and buy a pair of pants. The next day, the very next day, the damn things were loose. So I was buying clothes weekly. Felt good.
Esselman recommended the pills to friends, but their experiences weren't as positive. For instance, her sister ended up in the hospital with heart palpitations. Now meet Paul. He knows that pattern well.
The pills? Well, because I was gaining a lot of weight, and I don't like exercise at all.
Paul, who's asked that we use only his first name, runs a painting business in Stowe.
And I got a friend, he said, oh, you know what, we discovered a pill comes from Brazil, and that pill makes you lose about 10 pounds per week. And then I took those pills.
Unlike Esselman, Paul didn't speak to a doctor. He bought his pills here from a friend who had a supply. They cost the equivalent of $600 for 1 month, although as it turns out, his stint on the medication didn't last that long.
That really hurts my stomach, and I lost my appetite at all. I couldn't eat. And 2 weeks after, I lost 18, 20 pounds.
By the end of the first week, Paul felt a pinching in his chest. He called his doctor but didn't mention the diet pills. At a week and a half, his wife said he should go to the hospital. He didn't. By 2 weeks, it was really bad.
And my left arm and my left leg was total numb, and my chest was pain. And then I said, whoa, what's going on with me? And then they brought me to the hospital, and I had the heart attack right there.
The pills that Paul was taking are widely used among Brazilians in Massachusetts, but are largely under the official radar. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has warned previously about certain brands of diet pills from Brazil, but neither FDA nor Massachusetts state health officials has heard of these pills, which are complex mixtures developed by individual doctors in Brazil and manufactured in batches by Brazilian pharmacies.
I have a few things to share with you.
Peter Cohen probably knows more than anyone in Massachusetts about the pills. He's a Somerville primary care doctor who sees a lot of Brazilian patients. The ingredients vary, but Cohen has found that the capsules typically contain multiple drugs.
If we go down here, we can see that we have ephedra, dimethylpropylon, which are both amphetamine-type medications. We have Valium, diazepam. There's some laxatives, thyroid hormone in this one, Lasix for as a diuretic, caffeine.
The pills are a cocktail of nearly every kind of drug ever tried for weight loss, as many as 17 jumbled together in one capsule. Cohen has learned to ask his Brazilian patients if they're taking the pills. He says most users are women, most relatively young.
And I would venture to guess that approximately 1 in 5 of my young Brazilian women have tried it sometime while they're here in the United States.
Members of the Brazilian community told us the pills are available from a cafe in Alston, a jewelry store in Somerville, and extensively through other informal sales networks. The pills are illegal, but how risky are they? Peter Cohen says most patients experience some side effects, often tremors, nausea, dizziness, and mood swings. I met Camila Vieira in East Cambridge. She had just stopped taking diet pills prescribed by her mother's doctor in Brazil. Earlier, she'd tried another brand, pills sold right here in Massachusetts.
We call mouse venom because it's very dangerous.
Vieira says she stopped the mouse venom pills after only 3 days because they gave her heart palpitations. But she knows a woman who's been taking them for years.
I have a friend that takes those diet pills for a long time. She's shaking and I can tell that she's just addicted of that medication. And she knows that she's addicted too.
Sudden weight loss itself carries a risk, as does rapid rebound weight gain. The thyroid hormones in the pills are another risk.
Okay, so here's her blood tests. She has way too much T3 in her system.
In her office at Cambridge Hospital, endocrinologist Melanie Brunt has just seen a patient referred for thyroid abnormalities. The patient's been taking Brazilian diet pills, and the label on the bottle indicates that they have a whopping dose of 3 different thyroid hormones, which regulate metabolism. Brunt has seen several such patients and regularly gets calls from primary care doctors about others.
So here's the normal range is 87 to 178. Her level is 432. Which is very elevated. And this is somebody who has a psychiatric disorder that could be made worse by this.
So how big a health risk do you think this is?
She's likely, if she stays on it long enough, to develop symptoms and signs of toxicity, which would be very fast heartbeat or arrhythmias. She could develop extreme anxiety, insomnia, tremulousness.
And for another patient who had an underlying heart disease, it could be life-threatening?
Yes, definitely.
In the course of reporting this story, we repeatedly heard of patients hospitalized after taking the pills. Most of these accounts were impossible to confirm, but one study from Brazil suggests surprising toxicity. A survey of more than 1,000 diet pill users found that 86% reported some kind of adverse effect, almost 40% sought medical attention, and 4% of patients, 1 out of every 25 who took the pills, had been hospitalized because of side effects. It's a steep price to pay for thinness, but Dr. Elena Santos Martins says many in Brazil are willing to pay it.
The fact is that in Brazil, the culture of the body is quite important.
Santos sees a large Brazilian population at East Cambridge Health Center. She says her patients often gain weight when they come to the U.S., so many turn to pills and cosmetic surgery, which are common back home. Indeed, it's only been a year since a young woman in Framingham died from an illegal liposuction procedure performed by a doctor from Brazil. Santos says that puts the pills in context.
I've seen by speaking to some of my patients that they thought that they were making the safest decision by taking a pill. They are not going under anesthesia, they are not going into an operating room.
And those attitudes may be common. Doctors confirm that they're starting to see the use of diet pills by non-Brazilian patients. One of them is Odette Esselman, who went from size 14 to size 6. She gained back all that weight when she stopped taking the pills, and she says her blood pressure went through the roof and has stayed high. Still, she says, it's tempting.
If I knew that it wasn't the pills that did my blood pressure, it had to have been. But if I knew for a fact that it was not, I'd do it again.
Our piece on the legal sale of Brazilian diet drugs in Massachusetts was produced by Here Now's Alan Cockle. Still to come, jazz, here now. Well, from Iraq today, there's word that the month of May has been the deadliest for U.S. troops this year. On Memorial Day, at least 10 American soldiers died in roadside bombings and a helicopter crash. So far, at least 110 U.S. military personnel have been killed in Iraq this month. Meanwhile, Britain's Foreign Office confirms that 5 British men were abducted in a brazen kidnapping in Baghdad today. Gunmen dressed in police uniforms seized the men from a finance ministry building. So far, no one's claimed responsibility for those kidnappings. Well, is there any way to stem the raging violence in Baghdad? As we've reported here, military officials say building walls is the answer. In fact, on the website military.com today, the top counterinsurgency advisor in Iraq says building walls around Baghdad neighborhoods to stem sectarian violence is like using a life-saving tourniquet to save a dying patient. Well, the Sunni suburb of Ahmadiyya was the first to have a wall built around it last month. A spokesperson for the American military tells Here Now that the wall is a temporary protective barrier and says similar structures are going up throughout Baghdad as needed. Well, according to the latest reports, the Ahmadiyya Wall is 12 feet high and 3 miles long. Both Shiites and Sunnis have protested it. They don't see it as a life-saving tourniquet, but as a barrier to peace. We recently spoke with Abdullah Omar, a 49-year-old accountant who lives in Ahmadiyya. He told us about the wall and started by describing what it looks like.
Well, it's ugly, dark gray. You can't imagine when you are live among all these walls, and they are all gray, dark gray, and you have to see it every day. After 4 years, we were looking for something better, open areas, better services, not more restrictions. For example, if you have time to hear this. Today I tried to go to work. I had to drive for 2 hours, jam traffic, checkpoints. They are making checkpoints even on the highways. I couldn't reach my work, so I had to drive back to home.
Well, they are saying it's to make you safer. Do you feel safer?
Well, we are looking for the government to protect us, but we don't trust these guys, because they are the same guys who issued the dead groups, the gangs who kill innocent people. They are the same people who are now responsible for this plan.
You're saying you don't trust them because they are the same people who were behind gangs that were doing killings before, and now they are in the Iraqi army and the police force. How is the wall affecting you and your connection to your parents?
Yesterday, I wanted to go to visit my family in the afternoon at 6 p.m. When we reached this entrance, the only entrance to Al Adamiyya, a Hummer came and stopped in the middle of the road. 2 soldiers stepped out of it and ordered all the vehicles just to turn around and find somewhere else to go through. So I just had to turn around and go back to my home. I couldn't reach my parents. And because there is only one entrance, so many cars will be jammed there, and they're searching car by car, so it will take a long time.
Do you think in a funny way the walls might actually unite you and your Sunni neighborhoods with Shiites, in that Shiites are against the walls too?
Of course they are. We live together for more than 1,000 years, and we didn't have this problem before. It's something new came with this occupation and came with this new government. These authorities are responsible for our security, to take care of us, but not in this ugly way. We thought they would be efficient enough to open the areas, to make people feel safe and have more connections with other tribes, people from other suburbs, not to divide us apart. That's what we are looking for. Because with these walls, the divide between the people here will be more and more.
Abdullah Omar, a 49-year-old accountant who lives in the Sunni suburb of Ahmadiyya, where a wall is being built. Abdullah, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, and thank you for hearing us. And we all hope that things will be better.
All right. After a quick break, new music from John Abercrombie, Daryl Grant, and new sensation, 78-year-old Ed Reed. Got some jazz coming for you in a minute, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
When you're in love and you are wondering.
Every once in a while, there comes a voice from out of the blue. It's fresh, clear, unaffected, not quite like any other you've ever heard. This one belongs to Ed Reed.
There's an ancient sign sure to tell you when your search is over and done. Catch a bee, and if he don't sting you.
Well, Here Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs has brought Ed Reed to us. And so, James, begin your visit by telling us about this exceptional new singer. He's from Richmond, California, in the San Francisco Bay Area.
He is.
What else do we need to know about him?
Well, yeah, Robin, Ed Reed is a new voice, and he's also 78 years old. The snippet we just heard from the standard tune called A Sleepin' Bee is from Reed's very first album ever. 78 years old, and he makes his debut disc. The disc is on Reed's own label, Blue Shorts. The title is Ed Reed Sings Love Stories, and it is absolutely ravishing from beginning to end. And incidentally, A Sleepin' Bee has music by Harold Arlen and poetic lyrics by...
I only know this because you told me. Yeah. Truman Capote?
That's it, Truman Capote. They collaborated on a 1954 musical called House of Flowers, whose cast included a very young Diane Carroll.
Also known for her television roles, Dynasty and Julia.
Mm-hmm.
So why has it taken so long for Ed Reed to come to us?
Well, Robin, one word. Heroin.
Mm.
Reed became addicted in 1946. He was 17 years old at the time. He was in the Army in Oakland, California. And for the next 40 years, he was pretty much strung out. He served four terms in two of California's toughest prisons, San Quentin and Folsom. When he was in San Quentin, he sang with a band that included such fellow inmates as alto saxophonists Art Pepper and Frank Morgan, and drummer Frank Butler. All of these guys top-notch improvising artists, of course. Reed got out of prison for the last time in 1966, but he kept getting high until 1986. Then he straightened out. Ed Reed began singing in the Bay Area clubs in the late 1980s, but it wasn't until 2005, when he met and performed with a multi-instrumentalist named Peck Almond, that Reed was convinced by Almond that he should record. Last year it happened.
So what else does he do? I mean, what is he doing with his life?
Well, he tours a little bit. He plays regularly in the Bay Area. And his day job is that he's a substance abuse educator and counselor.
Hmm.
So he's doing good work in various ways. The thing I like most, I think, about Ed Reed's voice, aside from the way he phrases, is that it contains both masculine and feminine qualities. Now, there's no question that we're hearing a male singer, but there's a certain delicacy there as well. This is one of the most gorgeous songs in the Billy Strayhorn songbook, and that songbook is filled with alluring melodies and poignant lyrics. Once again, Ed Reed, with a bit of Billy Strayhorn's A Flower is a Lovesome Thing, with the aforementioned Peck Almond on bass clarinet here, and at the piano, Gary Fisher.
A sailor's drinking pale moonbeams, gardenias floating through daydreams. Wherever it may grow, no matter where you go, a flower.
So that's Ed Reed making his recording debut at the age of 78.
And I hope that there are many more albums to come from Ed Reed.
And don't forget, we'll, of course, have this list for you at our website, here-now.org. Who's next?
Well, Robin, I thought we'd change the sound and the groove entirely as we turn to the guitarist and composer John Abercrombie's new disc for ECM. It's called The Third Quartet. I would say that John Abercrombie is among the most respected, versatile, and to my mind, essential guitar players of the past 30 or 35 years. This new album is in some ways chamber jazz.
Hmm.
In addition to Abercrombie's guitar, there's Mark Feldman's violin. Mark Johnson, best known for his work in Bill Evans' Final Trio, is on bass. And drummer Joey Barron rounds out the band. Barron has radar ears, I think, and an uncanny ability to think fast. This is an ensemble that's been together on and off, I would say, like 22 years, something like that, 23 years. Now, two musicians who had significant effects on John Abercrombie's music, both as soloist and composer, are not guitar players at all. I'm speaking of the alto saxophonist and composer Ornette Coleman
mm-hmm.
and the late pianist-composer Bill Evans. So you've got the free side,
and you've got the more lyrical side. The piece that we've been listening to is called Banshee. It leads off the album called The Third Quartet, and this is the third album by these four musicians. The tempo is up, but the provocative theme is stated at half the tempo, which is an Ornette Coleman-esque move. Listen to the interplay between guitar and violin and how drummer Joey Barron responds. Again, this track is called Banshee, the John Abercrombie Quartet.
Sounds of John Abercrombie.
Great stuff.
Well, with your recommendation, we write that one down. Finally, a keyboardist composer who's been around a little while, but again, not a household name. Tell us about Darryl Grant.
Well, he's in his mid-40s. Darryl Grant lives in Portland, Oregon. He's played with such giants as Betty Carter, Tony Williams, and Roy Haynes. And he's recorded at least, I'm going to guess, half a dozen albums as a leader. He's just released a 2-CD set on the Origin label called Truth and Reconciliation, on which he plays various keyboards, but mostly the grand piano, and he occasionally sings, serviceably. Grant also deploys a few samples. We hear, for example, the voices of Dr. Martin Luther King, John F. Kennedy, and Nelson Mandela.
I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities.
Coming like a river through plains.
Well, we know that the truth and reconciliation process in South Africa, mm-hmm. you know, helped people, you know, victims of apartheid and perpetrators of violence face each other, tell truth. So that explains the voice of Mandela, but also JFK and Dr. King. What do you think there?
Well, Darryl Grant uses these samples to make a simple point. Hear well the words of these truth-tellers because the world is not yet a lost cause, although I must admit to wondering about that every single day.
Hmm. Yeah. Tell us about Darryl Grant's sound.
Yeah, Darryl Grant gets a crystalline sound from the piano. It's apparent he's listened closely to, Herbie Hancock, Keith Jarrett. He's also written a group of inviting and attractive originals in this 2-CD set. But Robin, I want you to hear how beautifully he interprets the Jerome Kern classic, The Way You Look Tonight. Usually, jazz improvisers handle this tune at an up to very up tempo. Darryl Grant, on the other hand, wrings every bit of feeling from The Way You Look Tonight without ever becoming maudlin with it. He's got Joe Locke on vibes, John Patitucci on bass, Brian Blade the drums, and all of these musicians are currently at the top of their profession. Here's Darryl Grant's take on The Way You Look Tonight. So beautiful.
It's like a prayer.
Yeah, like a hymn.
Darryl Grant from his new 2-CD set, Truth and Reconciliation. Just beautiful, James. Thanks so much.
Robin, it's always my pleasure. And let me invoke the words of a long-ago Ornette Coleman tune. The title of it is Beauty is a Rare Thing. See you soon.
Here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more on James Jazz Picks, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.